I'm Becky, and welcome to another episode of the Salty Mums podcast, where we explore motherhood from a Christian perspective through women's stories and wisdom to help us remain the salt of the earth in today's culture.
Hello, and welcome back to season 3 of the Salty Mums podcast. I'm so glad to be back, and I do apologise about how sporadic this season has been, but I promise you it's worth the wait. I've got some excellent guests to finish off the season, including a Christmas special, which I'm really excited about. And I'm not going to witter on for too long, because we've got an excellent guest today, but it's quite a long one, but it's totally worth buckling in and listening to the whole episode, because I found this guest so interesting and the time flew by with her. And this guest was actually recommended to me by a lovely gentleman in my church who is involved in the Christian publishing world and said, you've got to get this lady on. She's a powerful advocate about the issue around faith and menopause, and she's got a book coming out in October, which happens to be Menopause Awareness Month, which I'm guessing was on purpose, and it's out now, and we'll talk about that more later. But this really sparked my interest because I've noticed a subtle shift in algorithms on social media, and I'm no longer being shown lots of things about babies and young children and things, but it's I don't know whether it's picked up on what I'm talking about or what I'm looking at or just looking at my age, but it's showing me things like skincare routines and how to dress for your age, or I can't think of anything else off the top of my head. Getting your supplements in, making sure you work out past the age of 35 and get your muscle strength up. And it made me wonder, well, what does this look like in the context of motherhood and faith as well? So I was delighted that Jane Manfredi agreed to come on. So with no further ado, I'll pass on to my lovely chat with her. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
How are you this morning?
I'm really, really good, actually. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm an Anglican deacon, and I'm a mum of four. I'm married to Leo. We live in Crewe in the Northwest. You may have travelled through it by train. Most people have.
On the way up to Scotland.
I've lived there all my life. I was born there. Three of my children were born there. I'm a writer and a teacher.
What do you teach?
History. Not in a school at the moment. I do private tutoring.
Oh, cool. Cool. Favourite subject of school, history.
So, yeah. Oh, excellent.
Now, before we get stuck into our main topic, because you're going to talk about menopause and aging today, as you know, although not people listening may know, I ask all my guests to fill in a brief questionnaire. And on the last question, you added this gem of a comment of, I'm also from a working class background. I have lots of thoughts on how this informs how I should be salt and light in the world. And as well, the Salty Mums podcast, I'd love to hear you unpack this a little bit and contrast with perhaps how the church, which I guess could be seen as quite middle class at times, perhaps perceives being salt and light. Sorry, I need to put my teeth back in.
Well, it's I think class is just such an odd one, actually. I've written about it fairly recently on my Substack. It's a strange thing because, to all intents and purposes, I'm middle class now. I think if you are ordained minister in the Church of England and you've been educated to a certain standard, and I live in a very middle class part of my town. So I feel it's odd, but yeah, my background is definitely working class. I was raised on a council estate. My dad is very, very working class, and all my family are pretty much. And I think the main difference I've noticed is communication style. I find, especially amidst the higher up you get in the hierarchy of the Church of England, I find it, yeah, it is very, very middle class. And that's not necessarily a negative thing, but it does feel like a culture clash when you that's not your background. And it's definitely felt like that for me. So yeah, the communication style is very, very different. I find that working class people, especially the where I grew up, are very, very direct. Very direct, very frank. And I think that the communication style of some of the people, possibly most of the people in the Church of England, is can be tend towards the passive aggressive. because I think that, oh gosh, there's all sorts of issues, isn't there, to do with anger and raw emotion, and how that's I think the word that gets used is unpleasant. It's unpleasant to express certain emotions, and I think a lot of people are quite uncomfortable when emotions which are deemed to be unpleasant are expressed openly. Whereas for me and my family, that's just how we are. We don't mean anything by it, really, but we'd rather just say it than pretend that we're not feeling it and then let that emotion out sideways. Which I think is quite unhealthy. So yeah, I think that's the main thing, and I think that we are more likely to be salt and light if we are able to speak the truth in a real and authentic way. And if you're not able to do that, if you prize politeness more than you do being real, then you are less likely to be able to be salt and light.
I think that's really interesting. And I think it's something as parents generationally we've woken up to a little bit, haven't we, as well, of acknowledging feelings and sort of saying, actually, no, it's healthy to feel anger or to feel sadness. And but it's about the way you communicate that. Because obviously if you go in like there's like a scale, isn't there? There's like politeness and then there's just like
Yeah, and
the
there's
complete
outright
opposite.
rudeness.
Yeah, but then there's that frankness in the middle of actually just, and that's bringing light to it, isn't it? It's actually shining a spotlight on
Yeah,
actually.
definitely. And we don't get to, and I write about this in my book, because anger, it is that was one of the most common symptoms that came up that women were feeling during the perimenopause and menopause stage, was just, I'm just so angry. I've got really terrible hormonal rage, or just rage. And I think it's, we don't get to thrash about and cut people on the edges of our anger. That's not right. We're not called to do that. We can't go around indiscriminately hurting people just because we are angry.
Absolutely.
But if we are able to express that in safe ways without being chastised for it or slapped down because it's unpleasant, or because it makes people feel uncomfortable, I think we would have a healthier church.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that goes for so many topics, doesn't it, that we could look into. But we're going to talk about the menopause today. So let's start with the basics, because I did a little poll, not very scientific, on my Instagrams today as to how many of the listeners are in that sort of stage of life of menopause or perimenopause. And the majority of people were like, well, I'm not perimenopausal yet, but it's on my radar. So perhaps you could tell us first, could you maybe like sort of define the difference between perimenopause and menopause, but also what we can expect when we begin to enter the perimenopausal or the menopause?
Well, the first thing to note is that it differs massively. It would be so nice, wouldn't it, if we could say, oh, you hit 45 and then it starts, but obviously it doesn't. It differs hugely for every woman. There is a massive range of experiences. I think at the moment we are, because the conversation is so live, and culturally at least, it's an absolute explosion of information. it's a growth industry. This is mostly a really good thing, I think, because it means that women are thinking about it, women are talking about it, we're having conversations with one another in our friendship groups, we're having conversations online, it's on the TV, it's in radio, it's in podcasts, it's being written about. This is really good, because for so long, it was the silent passage that women went through in embarrassment and shame. It wasn't, you know, it was, oh, she's going through the change, you know, it was something that couldn't be talked about at all, and now it is being talked about, which is brilliant. But I think this leads to a lot of confusion. You know, there's such an avalanche of information, it's hard to know which bits to pick out that might be relevant to you. But for a general sort of, and it is a generalization, a general explanation of it, the perimenopause is the period that we have traditionally thought of as the change. So all those typical physical experiences that you might be having, so hot flushes, hormonal ups and downs, anything from getting hairier to weight gain, not being able to sleep, but all these things, they will be happening in the perimenopause phase. So during that phase, your estrogen levels are dropping. I mean, they're actually dropping from, I think, from when you're much younger than that, but you wouldn't start to notice it until, they say, roughly from 45 onwards, but it depends on the person. You may well experience symptoms before that. You might not experience symptoms till way into your 50s. I think one of the things is that because of the because it's such a hot topic, pardon the pun, because it's such a hot topic, I think women in their 40s are looking for it now. I definitely was. As soon as I hit 40, I started thinking, oh my gosh, this is happening now. I'm starting to go into perimenopause, and I'm not sure I was. I think vaguely I might have been. You know, you start noticing the first signs of it. For me, it was like I started putting on weight in areas where I hadn't put weight on before, like around my middle. That wasn't my shape. I'd never really carried weight there, and then all of a sudden, like, what's happening here? Why am I getting and where have these hairs come from? And so just things like that, nothing horrendous, but it was on my radar. And obviously I started that was when I started researching it.
Very good. And why this topic for a book? Like, why choose the menopause and the perimenopause?
Well, I was in my final year of theology college for ministerial training, and I was studying pastoral theology, and we had to do an assignment, and one of the things that we were told to look at was one stage of the life cycle. So some people were looking at birth, some people were looking at death, some people were looking at childhood, and I thought I was around 42 or something, at 43 at the time, so I thought I'll look at middle age, and I look at middle age for women, which for most women will include menopause. Now, I studied at the Queen's Foundation in Birmingham, which is a brilliant place to be if you're a woman, brilliant place to be if you're working class. It's a really great college, and some fabulous feminist theologians are there, including Nicola Slee, just for one. So I thought this will be a great place to study this, and I couldn't believe it when I looked into it. There was not a single book that had been written about it. Nothing. There was just nothing. There was not an article. There was nothing. So I looked into it a little bit more, and then I discovered that a fabulous priest called Julie Gittoes had actually given a paper about it, which I used as part of my research, and other than that, there wasn't, at the time, there wasn't anything. I believe there is now quite a lot of research going on, which is just brilliant. So I thought, as I started looking into it, I wrote my assignment, and I did really well on the assignment, and my tutor, who was again a brilliant woman, Methodist, called Barbara Glasson, she said, you need to keep writing. So I thought, well, if there's no book, I'll write one myself, because Not a book for not a book of academic, not an academic book. I want to write a book that addresses a pastoral need with theology in it, obviously, because it's going to be about faith in God. But more than anything else, I wanted it to be a piece of ministry, so it would address that pastoral need that I was seeing from people. Because one of the first things I did after discovering there was no research on this, I put a call out on social media and said, "Women of the church, are you wanting to talk about this? Are you wanting to talk about menopause and faith?" And of course, the biggest demographic in the church is that age group over women over 40. So I was absolutely inundated with people saying, "Well, yeah, nobody's talking about this. Let's talk about this." So we did, and we had a Zoom conversation. A few of us got together, and then after that, people filled in research questionnaires for me. People got in touch just off their own bat to talk about what was happening to them, what they were going through, experiences that they were having. excuse me,
It's fine. It's that time of
experiences they were.
year.
It's because we talked about coughing before and now I broke down coughing. People got in touch just to say, "Thank you for talking about this. I've not heard anyone mention this. And I'm so grateful." So after that, I thought, wow, I really want to meet this pastoral need that I'm seeing in women.
And what is that pastoral need? Because I'm pretending to be a skeptic here. Someone might say, well, that's a physical thing that you're going through is the menopause. What has it got to do with faith?
I think yes, it's primarily a physical thing. It's something that can dominate women's lives for up to a decade, possibly more in some cases. It also causes it can cause extreme emotional distress in women. We know that if women are susceptible, they have a past history of it. We know that depression is a big risk during the perimenopause phase. Just the emotional distortion that can happen is really distressing. So one of the most common refrains that I heard from women I spoke to, or women that got in touch, was to say, "I just don't know who I am anymore. I just don't know who I am." And that can be really distressing, particularly if you're having to experience that in silence and you're not allowed to talk about it. I'm a big believer that we bring our whole selves to Jesus, and we offer ourselves for healing, always for Jesus. So the church ought to be facilitating that, but we can't bring our whole selves if we're unable to talk openly about the things that are distressing us. And I don't mean that we ought to go into church and free bleed all over the pews, or it is happening, and it's not distasteful, and it's not gross, and it's not embarrassing. It's Why would it be? It's happening to at least 50% of people on the planet, or it's going to happen, or has happened. Why do we not talk about this openly? It may well not be a massive deal for every woman. I know of lots of women who their periods just stopped like that one day. There was no warning. They
Lucky
stopped.
them.
They never had another period.
Yeah.
And please God, that's what we hope for. That's what I hope for. But it's not like that for lots of women. And some women down the other end of the spectrum will have an absolutely horrendous time. And I hate the thought of women being alone in that and not supported by their church communities because everyone's too embarrassed to talk about it.
Why do you think we are embarrassed about things like this? I mean, I think there's been a shift in talking about periods in general, hasn't there? I mean,
I remember I used to like wait until the dryers went on in the toilets at school, you know, so you didn't hear like the rustling of like when you're on your period getting using new products or whatever. And now I couldn't give a
Yeah.
monkey's
I
what.
think having
Yeah.
children changes that though, doesn't it? That
Yeah.
after, you know, you can't
Yes.
be pregnant and give birth if you are in any way uptight about
Oh no, because
your
everyone sees
body.
everything. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you do lose a lot of yeah, like you say, uptightness. I was trying to think of the right
Yeah, I
word.
mean, I remember thinking, oh gosh, people are gonna see, like, you know, what will I look like when I'm giving birth? And everyone's gonna see. And then obviously by the time it happens, you don't care if the entire England football team walks in
I
the room. You don't care. You just like, just get the baby out. I don't care how you do it, I don't care who's watching, just get it out. Yeah, I mean, for me it's really strange because I suppose I should have said this in the background part, but I forgot. I wasn't raised a Christian at all. I was an atheist till I was 33. And then
Wow.
quite unexpectedly, and much to the horror and bemusement of my entire family, became a Christian. And I mean, that's for another podcast, maybe that's
Yeah.
it. But I think I was raised in a very different way, and I'm blessed that I was raised by a woman who is completely unfazed by anything to do with bodily functions. My mum was a gynecology nurse,
Oh, wow.
and she was just so open with everything and has no embarrassment filter, which was also a delight growing
Yeah.
up. But that made me, you know, it was a blessing. It was a real blessing because I've never felt uncomfortable about my body in that way. Other people will try and make you feel uncomfortable about your body, like that
Yeah.
periods are disgusting and you're meant to feel shamed for having them, or you might bleed onto your skirt when you're at school, or you
Yeah.
know, I mean, I had my fair share of those kind of experiences as well. But I knew that the problem wasn't me. I knew the problem was the world. And the world is uncomfortable with women's bodies, and I think the church in particular is uncomfortable with women's bodies. A part of the challenge I've accepted is to try and divest the church of some of that discomfort, without being deliberately shocking, but just being matter of fact. You know,
What do you think that's rooted in? That sort of shame of women's bodies?
Oh, there's a long, long history, and I certainly don't get into that in my book. There is a fabulous book that's just come out by Helen King, which is all about that history of women's bodies, the history of the clitoris and breasts and the womb, and she really digs into all that sort of stuff. So that's well worth a read. But it's a long history, isn't it? And some of it, I think, currently what we see is it's rooted as well in the middle classness. I really think that. And this idea that we can't talk about things which are unpleasant. I mean, just that word, unpleasant. I don't think anyone in my world ever used that word. I can't tell you how many times I've heard it said in the Church of England. Unpleasant. Yes, it's not the done thing. It's not nice to talk about vaginas and blood clots and all these
Yeah.
things that for women are part and parcel of our lives. They're normal, and they're not something, it's not disgusting.
Just a bodily function at the end of the day, isn't it? And can feel very, yeah, like isolating, can't it, if you're not able to share that with other people. You might feel you're abnormal if something is happening to your body and you don't know if other people are going through that. And you, I mean, this, we've maybe answered this, but you write menopause is not a disorder. And what do you mean by that, and what are the implications of that?
Well, as I said, there's been an avalanche of information. There are lots of very high profile advocates who have big platforms online, who have done absolutely brilliant work to raise the profile of women's health, to provide support for people and to get it onto the agenda. And I think mostly that's been really, really good. It's a positive thing. And I like the idea of middle-aged women having big platforms, actually. That's also a positive thing. but some of the language that gets used, I find, isn't in keeping with a responsible ethic of menopause, theologically speaking. I think that some of the language that gets used, perhaps unintentionally, can create an idea that menopause is something that is unnatural, almost something that women haven't always gone through, something that is going to really damage you physically and emotionally, and therefore we need to medicate against this for life, because it's going to cause us harm. And I was, during the research for my own book, I was really struck by a quote by from a book called Feminine Forever, by a doctor called Dr. Robert Wilson. And he sets himself up as a man who is battling a crippling disease, and the disease is menopause. And he writes, "Every woman faces the threat of extreme suffering and incapacity." Now, this man was, as it turns out, was funded by a pharmaceutical company who were making hormones. They were making hormone therapy. And this was written in 1966. Now, I am just wary of any arguments which stray into that kind of territory. I'm absolutely pro hormone therapy. Not that my opinion matters. I'm not a doctor, but I think that women should be able to access and take whatever therapy they need to feel better. So I'm pro women feeling better. So I'm not anti hormone therapy at all, but I am anti a treatment model that seems to want to push only that, and in increasingly higher doses, which isn't recommended by the Menopause Society, for one.
And that's sort of quite relevant in the news this week, isn't it? We're recording this on the 1st of October, and yesterday, and actually one of my listeners have sent in the question about that, and she said, did you see the recent Panorama documentary on... It's a particular doctor, isn't it? And are you concerned about menopause management becoming a business?
I'm concerned about online, the cult of personality, full stop. Mm. So I'm aware that just by talking about this, that will possibly lead to people sending me angry messages, because that's what usually happens when you criticize someone who is a very popular online figure. And that alone should raise questions for everybody. So what I would want to say is nobody is above scrutiny, absolutely nobody. And multiple truths can exist. So somebody can be doing something really, really good and something that is positive. And beneficial, but also there can possibly it can also be true that harm might be taking place. Mm-hmm. And we should never want to shut down debating that. Yeah. That should always be something that we are able to do. So I would want to question people who don't want to do that, who want to characterize legitimate questions as a witch hunt, for example, because I think that if we're saying we need to listen to women, and that our goal here is to raise the profile of women's health and for women's voices to be heard, that means all women, including the ones who are raising uncomfortable questions about people who we might otherwise think are doing a good thing. Mm. I'm trying to tread very carefully here, aren't I?
You did it very diplomatically. So I've seen, sort of moving from sort of, I suppose, a bit more of the physical element of it to sort of more the emotional side, I've seen you talk about and write about the becoming more invisible in sort of the stage of your life. And what do you mean by that? And why do you think that happens?
Oh my gosh, it's such a. I've actually got a piece coming on my Substack about this because this is one of my pet topics. Because I think women don't like to talk about this. I have read some absolutely fabulous pieces over on Substack by older women about the process of what happens when you get older and how discombobulating that can be. I think we don't like to talk about it because it makes us sound vain. And we're above all that, especially if we're Christian. We're supposed to not care about these things. So before I say anything else, I have to say that I am married, obviously, to Leo, who loves me very much. So it's not this isn't coming from a place of personal insecurity. It's just an observation, really, that as you get into your 40s, you just aren't as You're just not as visible as you once were. You don't get looked at in the same way that you once did. Nobody seems to be as interested in what you've got to say anymore, or you can feel you can feel like nobody sees you at all, which is both it is blessing but also feels like curse in some ways. I think that my challenge has been to utilize it. So invisibility absolutely can be a blessing. And when I go out with my daughters who are 20 and 16, you realize that, wow, I'm so glad that that doesn't happen to me anymore, as they, can't go anywhere without being horns on cars hooting when they walk down the road, or they're getting leered at past building sites. And that was what it was like when I was younger. And it's horrible, walking past a building site trying to fold yourself in to make yourself invisible so that you don't get seen and noticed, and attract unwanted attention. Well, hey, you get to your 40s and you don't have to fold yourself in anymore. You are invisible. But that feels really strange at first. But it absolutely is a blessing. It is a blessing. And of course the my prayer would be that nobody has to fold themselves in ever. That I don't think that it's not fair that younger women should bear the burden of the male gaze either. I talk about it in my book about the invisibility, and I specifically reference Kate two examples. So I reference Kate Moss, who when she turned 50 last year, I think, or possibly the beginning of this year, last year. And the way it was talked about was like she was the last white rhino in Africa dying. It's like, oh, she's turned 50, and she must look at her own daughter and just feel terrible because it reminds her of what she once was. And like, this kind of language is just so insidious. And it does two things. It reaffirms that older women are of less value to the world. And it also drives a wedge between younger women and older women, because it plays into that age-old trope of the old embittered crone who is jealous of the beautiful young Snow White type character. And that's just not true. And in the church in particular, older women have a real stake, and in being a source of wisdom for younger women, but they can't be that. They can't fulfill that role if there's this wedge between us that seeks to divide us, and makes us competitive with one another. And I really hate that. And just to amuse myself, I also googled Daniel Craig turning 50, and completely different, complete which will surprise nobody, completely different headlines on offer for him. It's all, wow, fittest 50-year-old you've ever seen, doesn't he look great? And that's not to say that men aren't affected adversely by their own aging. They are. I think that it can be quite wounding for men too, but I think that culture is far more disgusted by the aging of women than it is by men. And one of the ways that women are punished for aging is by being rendered invisible. And I rebuke that. I rebuke that in the name of Jesus. I rebuke it because I feel like I'm stronger than I've ever been. I'm wiser than I've ever been. I'm more present in my own life than I've ever been. And I like myself more than I ever have done when I, you know, definitely went from when I was younger. And all that tells me is that God absolutely values me as a woman of my age and will continue to do so as I get older. And that's really important for midlife women to remember.
Absolutely. And it's so funny that, because as I was researching you this week, and I noticed you talking about some of these issues of aging, it's something that's been on my mind a lot recently, because I mean I'm only 36, but I've noticed a massive uptake or pressure to defy aging in all sorts of ways that even our mums weren't pressured to. Like, my mum always had a skin routine, you know, with her E45 moisturizer, but that was about as far as it went. And you know, you know women have always had that pressure to stay looking trim, but like my 29-year-old cleaner gets regular Botox now, and I'm like, how am I meant to keep up with this? Like, what is this about, like not ever looking like we're aging at all? And
it's terrifying. Oh gosh, I've got so many thoughts about this. We could have done a whole podcast just on this. It's really odd as you get into your 40s and there are hardly any public role models who look like you. I mean, I don't expect to look like a Hollywood star. I don't mean level of attractiveness. I mean, there's no one who has my forehead.
You know, looks like, very nice from here.
Oh my gosh, I've got lines on my forehead. Like, it's weird, but it's not weird. It's completely normal to have for your face to move. And suddenly you don't see those examples. And I was listening to a podcast with Kate Winslet, on Elizabeth Day's podcast. And I don't believe Kate's had any work done. Her face certainly has lines on it. She looks like a woman who is in her late 40s. Mm. Beautiful, obviously, but that's what she looks like. And it was so refreshing to see. And I that shouldn't be refreshing. That should be the norm. Mm. And I think there's a film out at the moment with Demi Moore that addresses some of these issues. I think is it called The Substance or Substance? I read an article about it yesterday, and it looks at those sorts of things, like what is it like to age as a woman, and why are we so horribly fascinated with it when we see women doing it without having work done? And it's a no-win situation. You have work done, and then you get mocked and chastised for having had the work done. If you don't have the work done, you get mocked and chastised for aging. So you can't win. Yeah. You can't win.
And how do we respond to that from a faith perspective of sort of, because, you know, I have invested in some creams and serums too. I mean, I've got at 36, after having two children who didn't sleep, my skin has definitely aged. I definitely look 36. And I had this moment at the supermarket a few weeks ago where I had my sunglasses on, and she's like, oh, I think I need to ID you. And I put my sunglasses up and went, I said, oh really, you know? And she went, oh no, you're all right. And I'm like,
oh my gosh. And she could have still asked you out of kindness.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have my ID, so I was quite glad that she didn't have it. But it's like, yeah, my age now, don't I? But like, so I, you know, I do definitely sort of invest in my skin a little bit, partly also because you get out the shower and you feel like, I don't know, someone's sucked all the dryness out of your skin these days, don't you? But like, as women of faith, you know, how do we engage in that culture? Do we run from it, or do we sort of sit somewhere in the middle as such?
Oh gosh,
that's a big question.
I wouldn't have any I mean, I can't afford it, actually. I don't know what I'm saying. It's like it's a viable option for me. I can't afford Botox or
No.
fillers or whatever the heck else people have done. I use cheap cream from Sainsbury's.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So it's not even a viable option for me. If I had the money, I don't know whether I would feel differently. I'd like to say I would because I was born with a cleft lip. So I've had a lot of surgery on my face, people messing about with my mouth and my nose, and for years and years and years until I was 26, I think was the last surgery I had done. So the last thing I want to do is have anyone putting needles near my face or messing with my face. And also, I think because of that, my face has never been perfect. So, and you can't help it if you've got a quite a visible scar on your face. You can't, everyone can see it. You can't ever hide it. So I kind of made peace with my face a long, long time ago. And as it ages, it's odd. Like you kind of don't notice it. I think, oh gosh, I actually look okay. I think you just lie to yourself. And then I'll see, my kids will take a horrendous picture of me because they're awful because I've got teenagers, using that 0.5 setting on
Oh
the phone, and they'll come and like snap you, and they'll think it's hilarious, and you just look horrendous. And then I think, oh my gosh, I look my age. I really, really do. But as
like your age this morning. It's
oh,
you know, you're
thank you. You're
40,
too, too kind.
but
Thank
maybe I
you.
should say to you, embrace it.
I mean, it is what it is. You
Yeah.
know, it is what it is. And I think that my faith helps me to embrace acceptance.
Yeah.
It helps me to embrace acceptance. And one of the things I've written about, and that I feel quite passionately about, is that the biblical record, while it doesn't talk about menopause specifically, there are plenty of examples in there of older women who are postmenopausal, who God values and who God gives a big role in his story. So I'm thinking of Sarah, for example. I'm thinking of Elizabeth. I'm thinking of Naomi. These are all women who, from a biblical perspective, were past the point of reproductive usefulness, at a time when women's the purpose of women was to make babies. These were women who, in two of those cases, who hadn't done that, and who weren't going to be doing it anymore. So I think they're good archetypes for midlife women. Obviously, we can't neatly map midlife onto biblical times because it didn't exist as a thing back then. So I see those women as examples of God trusting them and wanting them to be repositories of new life, of fertile ground for God to work out God's purposes. That tells me that my life's not done. The best years aren't over. The best is still to come. The best is still to come. And it might not feel like that sometimes. In good grief, the last couple of years, my life definitely hasn't felt like that. My 40s have been really, really hard, for all sorts of reasons. And I think they are for lots of people. So I don't want to irritate anyone with the whole, aren't we so great, girls? It's going to be great. And let's just, slay or any of that. Because you have to acknowledge the dark along with the
Yeah.
light. You can't be light unless you're acknowledging that there is considerable dark. And people's midlife and menopause journey may well contain darkness, and really hard times. But that's not the full story. That's not the full story. I believe in our God of resurrection. And I think that menopause is a site of resurrection. It's a death. We are seeing in real time the death of our younger selves. We're seeing the death of our fertility. That can be deeply, deeply painful for women. If you've had fertility issues, or if you're child free, or even if you're child free by choice, that can be incredibly painful. It's a definitive ending, isn't it? It's a point of no return. That's a point where, in that sense, hope is dead. It's like a Holy Saturday, isn't it? It's that abiding in that hopelessness. And that's something we have to work through. But God is beside us when we are working through that. And we know, because we believe in Jesus, that there is resurrection coming.
That's beautiful, because I was talking to a friend before recording this morning, and I was like, oh, I'm really excited. I'm doing this podcast on the menopause. And I was like, she's really refreshing about it. And I said, she sort of talks about it as a almost a renewal. And my friend was like, yeah, rather than the beginning of the end. And I was like, yeah, that's how I think a lot of women see it, don't they? That's sort of the
But
beginning of the end
sometimes
of their
things
life.
begin where they end.
Yeah.
Jesus ended. Good Friday is an ending. And for his followers on that Saturday, that in between time, they definitely would have felt this full sting of that. They didn't know what was coming. And I think we forget that as Christians because we know. He rises up from the grave. We know that surprise, he's coming back. It is no surprise for us, is it? Because we know that, and we are Easter people, and we abide in that. So it's easy to skip over that in between stage, Holy Saturday. And I think that I've seen connections between that and this midlife perimenopausal phase can feel it a heck of a lot like Holy Saturday for lots of people, especially if depression is part of your experience, as it has been mine. And that definitely feels that you can feel the full force of the hopelessness of Holy Saturday. But God is, and I know God is with us in that. I know that God is with us because there is nowhere that God will not go to be beside his children. So I know that God is there, and I also have hope that resurrection is coming.
Absolutely. That's beautiful. I love that. And what can we, because I always like to get some practical things that we can do, because it's the Salty Mums podcast. It's about being salty and about being light in the world. How can we support each other, women in our church through that Holy Saturday as such of life, that stage? What can we do better?
So I think the first thing that we can do is be open about it, to speak the truth about the things that are happening without shame and without fear of reprisal. So what I mean by that is without fear that we will be seen as weak because we acknowledge that, I'm actually not, I'm not doing great with this. I'm really struggling. The church should be able to step into that and support women without accusing them of not being resilient enough or being somehow not able to do the jobs that they were once able to do. I obviously know a lot of clergy and women in positions of leadership in the church. And they've spoken to me about feeling like they're not able to chair a PCC meeting because they feel so anxious, or they feel they're worried about having a hot flush during presiding at the altar, or they're having to wear white robes and they're bleeding really heavily. They're hot in the robes. There's no toilets in this old church that they're trying to run. So we can take care of some practical concerns that women might have, of prioritizing it by admitting that women have bodies that have particular needs, and that we might stop pretending that
We don't.
the neutral human is male, because no, that's not how it is. I also would like to see it talked about openly in prayer. When have you ever heard anyone mention menopause in intercessions?
No.
Why not? There are no hymns that highlight this time, and I mean, there's very few that are specifically just about women, but not about this particular period in a woman's life. Liturgy, I think, has a big role to play. I know some very talented liturgists who are researching topics that are adjacent to my area of research. That sounds so pretentious. It makes me sound like an academic, and I'm not an academic.
Embrace it. You are an author. You've written a book.
But Alice Watson is a fabulous liturgist, and she's researching childbirth. So I think that that there's stuff happening. It just needs to be a little bit more open, I think. Who else am I thinking? Karen O'Donnell has also written. She's written about Mary, Jesus's mother, as Mary the crone. So Mary is middle-aged and menopausal, and I think she had some suggestions for ways we can work that into liturgy. The stuff is happening, but I think the main thing we can do to shine a light on it is to just to be truthful, just to be open, just to share our stories, share them with one another, share them with within our churches. That's the most helpful thing that we can do.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I had a listener send a question about whether she wasn't coping with life because she's perimenopausal or just because she's taken too much on. And I mean, it could be both of those things, but like you know, a lot of women in their 40s perhaps tend to have a bit older children, so they have more space for helping at church and things like that. And I suppose giving those women the space as well to say no, and not that I think sorry, I'm coughing now. Any churches mean to make people feel guilty, but there can be a undercurrent of pressure, can't there, sometimes, that well, it won't happen if we don't have these volunteers. And just allowing women to have that space to struggle.
I mean, I've never met a woman who wasn't extremely put upon and extremely guilty. Almost every woman I know, but definitely every mother I know, feels both of those things. And I think that is something that does get worse as you get older, because then you end up, a lot of women are in this sandwich generation where they're taking care of elderly parents as well as still looking after teenagers or young adults. It's really hard. And I think one of the, well, as I've said, all the information that we're being gifted with at the moment regarding menopause is putting us on high alert for symptoms, and I worry that we attribute everything to perimenopause when some things can be a combination of you're aging. One of the online questionnaires that from again a very popular menopause influencer online, my husband filled it in and he scored very highly. I mean, that's without the vaginal dryness, you know, and the hot flushes, but everything else he had ticked, because guess what, some of this is aging. It's aging. Some of these things happen because you're getting older, and I worry that we are attributing everything to perimenopause when sometimes it might not be. So that's something that is worth thinking about as well. There are so many pressures on women. So many pressures. I see so many of my friends who carrying the weight of the world, and that doesn't seem to get easier or better as you get older. So then if that then collides with hormonal upheaval, you're in trouble.
Absolutely. And that's a whole other podcast again, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh gosh.
The
yeah.
burdens that women carry. And just because you mentioned about your teenagers there, just one more thing before we sort of start to wrap up a little bit. One thing you mentioned in some of your writing is the intersection between midlife and raising teens and tweens. And what impact do you see that having on you or us?
I think it's really difficult because teenage, I mean, we talked before, didn't we, about teenage girls. So my teens, my kids are 20, 16, 14, and 11. So the two older ones are, so one isn't actually a teen at all, but there is, damn it.
Yeah.
The two older ones are girls. So they've got their own hormonal stuff going on. Boys obviously have hormonal things going on too. But I think with the girls, it's been far more challenging. So their hormones are all over the place. I don't think my hormones are all over the place yet, if they will be. I've noticed that things are changing. Like my cycle has got really short compared to what it was. That's actually a blessing because I get really terrible PMT before my period. So if I can, decrease that time when I'm feeling lousy, that's really good. But my husband has said that he feels the poor guy. He said that he feels that my PMT hasn't been as bad lately. So I don't know. Maybe is that a symptom? Please, God, let that be a symptom of perimenopause. It's not as bad as it once was because my estrogen levels are lower. I don't know. But I can see how for lots of women, it's a huge challenge. You're raising hormonal teenagers whilst feeling really hormonal yourself. So you're that sounds like a collision course, doesn't it? That's a real clash of hormones. That can be really challenging. And I don't know what the answers are to that, other than just being open with your kids. I think one of the things that I've tried to model with my children, not always successfully, but I've tried, is to say sorry. to say sorry. I'm so proud that my kids know how to apologize. For whatever else they've got, gosh, they are not perfect. Please don't ever think that I have perfect children. I really, really don't. And I'm not a great mother. I'm really not. But we know how to say sorry in our house. And that means a lot. That really means a lot. That can really restore a moment by knowing how to say sorry. You're feeling hormonal, you said something you shouldn't say, you've lost your temper, you've not handled a situation as well as you might hope to. Say sorry. It really it say sorry, commit to do better. You won't, but because you're human. But say sorry and follow up with I love you. That always helps.
You've answered the question I was going to say, because I know sometimes that when I have PMT, I don't feel like my best Christian self, put it
No,
that way.
no. There's no fruit of the spirit during that week.
Was like, well, how do we like get around that? But I think it's like acknowledging that grace, isn't it? And acknowledging the importance of saying sorry. And
And it's the worst thing when someone says to you, my husband knows not to, to say, is your period due? That's just red rag to a bull, isn't it? Like,
Don't you dare blame my hormones, but actually, yeah, it's your hormones, so.
Oh, it's ghastly. See, again, I don't think we talk enough about PMT. PMT has blighted my life. It's ghastly. It's really awful. You can feel just terrible. And that rage, just so everything is irritating, everything.
I've had days where I felt so low, and I'm like, what is this about? Why, the world's against me. And the next day my period starts, and I'm like, oh, that's what it was. And
I've found logging it really, really helps. When I was younger, I think I would possibly just jot a P down on the calendar. And now I obviously have an app and I log it on that and monitor symptoms and things. And that's been really helpful for me to think, oh gosh, look, my cycle is now only 24 days and it was always 28 days. That's interesting, isn't it? I wonder what's causing that. Could it be? Could it be because I'm 45? Yes, it probably is. But it also helps me think, yeah, you feel terrible, Jane. You've probably only got three more days of this. Just hang in there. Don't kill anyone. It's gonna be fine.
Oh dear. Yeah, I know what you're going through.
But you see, we're just this conversation, just with the two of us, we're like, yeah, we feel seen because we're talking about it together. We feel seen. Here is someone else who understands what this is like, and we can laugh about it. Laughter is a huge balm for awful things, isn't it? And that's the kind of these are the kind of conversations that I want to encourage about menopause within Christian women in and outside the churches. Because we can be such a source of support and pastoral care for one another. And that's what I want my book to achieve more than anything. I want it to meet that pastoral need, and I want for women to feel seen.
Yeah, and we are the body of Christ, aren't we? And like, yeah, we know that God sees us in our troubles, in our hands, but sometimes us being the body, like literally seeing each other, can be that balm to one another and be that sort of healing influence of the internal angst about what we're going through.
Absolutely, which is why this mustn't be taboo, because taboos and things that are unpleasant and not we're not able to say keep people trapped within themselves, and it deprives them of the community experience of discussing a problem out loud without shame, and that's what's needed. So yeah, more truth telling, more storytelling, that's really good for women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I've got a couple of very quick fire questions, which I ask all the guests. So the first thing is, what piece of advice would you give yourself, give to yourself the day you first held your first child?
Oh my gosh. It was such a long time ago. I was only 24, 24 when I had her. And I was just so frightened. I was so frightened. And I, oh gosh, yeah, poor Jane. She was a terrible, terrible birth, really bad tear. Couldn't really walk properly for 2 weeks after I had her. My ex-husband was not supportive at all. It was a really, really hard time. So what I would go back and tell her, that frightened, anxious young woman, I would say, just love her, Jane. You don't have to do this perfectly. You don't have to do the breastfeeding perfectly. She doesn't always, you don't have to. I was so anxious. I was changing her clothes. She vomited a lot. I was changing her clothes like 10 times a day, ironing baby dresses.
What?
What was I
No.
thinking? What was I thinking? Because I had my way of coping with how I was feeling was to have be as perfect as I could be. And of course, there's no such thing. There's just no such thing. So what I would say to her is, Jane, your job is to love this child. That's it. It's not about achievement. It's not about seeking perfection. It's not about how soon she talks or walks or any of those things. It's to love her. So just focus on that. That's your job, and that's what I would tell her. And she's 20 now, and she's marvelous. She's wonderful, and it's not any of her achievements that make her wonderful. It's who she is.
She is,
And gosh, I can't even take credit for that, because it's all in God's hands, isn't it? But
can take some of the credit.
well, she's well loved,
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I did that part right.
Yeah. And the final quick fire question. If you could pray something over every mum listening, what would your prayer be?
Well, one of my favorite theological images and themes that I return to frequently, so frequently I have a tattooed on my wrist, is Elroy, so the God who sees. So it's Hagar in Genesis 13, I think it is. It's her word for God. She calls God El Roy because God sees her, the God who sees. And that is the motif, I think, that runs through a lot of my theology. So that's what I would want to pray over mums listening, that God sees. God sees every sleepless night. God sees when you are up with your child when they've got chicken pox. God sees every time you hide in the downstairs toilet and have a cry. God sees every time you got angry and shouted at your child and then cried after that because you felt guilty. God sees you getting them with a Vulcan death grip in church because they won't be quiet, and then you feel guilty for that because we feel guilty for everything. God sees that. God sees and God knows and God cares and God remembers when nobody else does. And your child won't remember either. That's the real tragedy. All that love, all that time, all that energy, you put it all in, and they don't remember it in any conscious way, but none of that love is wasted, and God sees it all.
Absolutely. Amen to
Amen.
that. Well, thank you so much. And if you want to find out a little bit more about Jane's incredible work, you can follow her on X. I was going to say Twitter, but no. At The Woman Frady. Is that how you say it? Man
The woman Freddie,
Frady,
yeah.
Woman Frady. You can follow her on Substack on Off the Rails. But more importantly, you can get her book, which is coming out this month.
It's out on the 24th of October. It's so
24th.
exciting.
Oh, and it's called Waking the Women, Faith, Menopause, and the Meaning of Midlife, out in October. So, and I loved your mum's, you posted on X about your mum's review of it, of I love your book. I never thought a book on menopause and God would be a page turner, but it is. And your mum's not a Christian, is she?
Oh my gosh, no, she's very anti-Christian. All my family are, really. They think it's as crazy as believing in fairies, you know. They don't understand it. But you know, they all came to my ordination. They all, you know, from all over the country they came, and
Amazing.
they love me, and they said they love what I do and they want to support me. So yeah, it's brilliant, actually. And she cried because I dedicated my book to her, and she didn't know, so I was real surprised when I handed her an advanced copy and she wasn't expecting it. So
Oh, that's
and she's
so
hard as
beautiful.
nails, my mum, as well, so
Is she
it was a
not a
nice
crier?
woman.
Well, before we go, can I pray for you, Jane?
Oh yes, please, thank you.
Lord, we thank you so much for Jane and the work that she's done on this gap in your church, Lord. And we pray over her as her book is released, that it empowers women and empowers the church to look after those women better, Lord. And I pray now for any woman listening in who feels lonely, who feels invisible, who feels in the storm of midlife hormones, that they feel seen by you and they feel seen by your people in this church. And in your name we pray. Amen.
Oh man, thank you so much for having me. I've had
Oh, my
a really
absolute
nice time.
pleasure. Thanks so much, Jane. Bye.
Thank you, bye.
Remember, all the links that we've talked about today can be found on our show notes. If you've enjoyed the podcast today, please do remember to hit subscribe if you haven't done already. And even better, you can help us reach a wider audience by giving a quick review on whichever platform you're listening on. See you next time.